welcome to a very special Halloween edition of the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader, and this week we are doing an all Q&A podcast. We've asked you for your questions over the last few days, and lo and behold, we got quite a few. So I'm going to read a couple of these questions, and we're just going to get them answered. So to help with this very difficult task, I have three regulars on the show, all the way from transplanted today from New York City, Andrew Martinick. How are you?
Hello, I'm doing fantastic. Not jet lagged or tired of any sort, because I just finished off my draft latte, and I'm ready to rock here.
What is a draft latte?
It's they like pre-mix a latte and they just have it on draft. It's kind of comes out like nitro cold brew, except for it has milk in it.
Okay.
It's fantastic.
I think. I have so many questions, but maybe I can save that for the end of this podcast.
Yeah, we do have a drink related question, and we could go from there.
All right. Well, we know what he likes to drink. Jerry Hildenbrand, welcome back to the show. I don't know really what you like to drink. What do you like to drink?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Right now I'm drinking a warm leftover Coors with a cigarette butt in it. But
amazing. That is the best answer I've ever heard.
That's extremely on brand, Jerry.
To be honest, I like Deer Park water.
Deer what?
Deer Park water. They sell spring water. That's what I usually drink.
Oh, it's like a brand. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I felt like you like go out to where the deers are and you bring a nice big.
The deer know where to find the good water, and Jerry
they
goes
do.
To that.
I mean,
park.
Obviously, I'm sure you have deer nearby where you live.
You can lead Jerry to water, but you can't make him drink.
There's a big story behind me and deer that involves a hatchet I had to buy from Amazon. I think Andrew remembers.
I definitely do.
They come up and they tear my garbage up, man, and they try to get their head in my kitchen window.
That does sound cute, though.
No, that's not cute. That's no.
That's we need. If you like to hunt deer, come to West Virginia every year, please. We don't have enough hunters.
That deer hating voice that you hear is our Wagoner. Welcome back.
Hate deer. I grew up in a neighborhood called Whitetail. I just know what a menace they can be.
You just endorsed murdering deer with a hatchet. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, that I can't. I don't even.
If
you know,
it's
I
trying
don't even
to
words.
Hurt your house, sure.
What is a deer gonna do to like a fortified house,
dude? They can peel off your siding.
They can break your windows.
Yeah, they're
trash your window screens.
They're a huge.
Have
nuisance.
You seen what they do to cars?
Yes, I'm actually joking you. I live in Canada. I've seen many of the leftover remains of a deer attack. I empathize, Jerry. But don't kill deer if you don't have to.
I try to scare them away. And if you bang something really hard or throw something at them, that works really well.
All right. Well, that's not one of the questions. But if you were interested in learning how to get rid of a deer problem, that's a good way to start.
Incredible. Whoever had the bingo square for talking about taking care of deer that are bothering your house, you got it.
But they do bring good water. You know, they carry it in a barrel around their neck.
Like a St. Bernard.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So we got a bunch of questions, so let's dive right in. And the way that we're going to do this is not really formalized, but we're going to, you know, I'll ask the questions and then somebody or all of us will kind of take turns answering. So we'll start with kind of a broad question. This is from MTL. When do you think smartphones will stop improving significantly from 1 year to the next, in case that hasn't already happened? And he said that he sent it from his Pixel 1, which came out in 2016. So Andrew, I'll let you begin, because this is a question we get a lot. You know, when should you upgrade? People are obviously waiting longer year over year to upgrade. But, you know, that doesn't really mean that smartphones aren't improving a lot still year over year.
Yeah, they are, of course, improving. It's not like we're taking steps backward. It's just we're not seeing dramatic improvements across all aspects of the phone with each generation. It's more of a, you know, improve a little bit here and then a little bit there. And he's right to point out that things have slowed down already. I mean, even from, I think the fact that he, you know, notes that he used a Pixel 1 to send that in is really important, because I feel like that late 2016 is a real good point to, you know, put down a little stake and say, okay, it kind of plateaued a little bit or started to plateau at that point. We didn't see, well, you know, versus the like 2012 to 2016 era was like, everything is just getting so much better every single time, not just from year to year within, you know, a Samsung phone or, you know, an HTC phone or whatever, but from one manufacturer to the other, it was really like battling it out. And now it's much more subtle. It's so much of the smartphone experience has been standardized on in terms of, you know, the hardware is really good across the line. It's not that hard to have the best specs, and all the displays are pretty good now. And like everything has gotten, like the floor has been raised across the board, and that's really good for everybody. But yeah, it does mean that, you know, you're not crazy if you're holding onto your phone for 2 years and not seeing a massive reason to buy a new $1,000 device today.
Jerry, is from a technology perspective, right? Like the stuff that's going inside the phones. I know the CPU industry has talked about hitting the edges of, you know, the limits of Moore's law. But is that same argument able to be applied to ARM and all of the tiny little chips that go inside the products that we buy?
Yeah, that's a little different, because the biggest breakthroughs are miniaturization. When you're talking, you know, super tiny ARM coprocessors and that kind of thing. I don't think Moore's Law really applies the same way, but it's difficult to say that next year's will be better, because you don't know what breakthroughs they'll have. All the companies that make these chips, they're really good at what they do, and they, every revision will have a tiny little change. And you don't see a huge leap like you would in, you know, a desktop processor. I think if you, I'll you know, parrot Andrew here. If, you know, if you have a Nexus 5 upgrade, but if you have a Pixel 1 and you don't just need to have any of the new features you've seen that require hardware, you're probably good to go. Same with an iPhone or a late model Samsung phone. They've gotten really good at, you know, putting the meaningful software updates in place that don't require new hardware. And I don't think it's crazy to hang on to your phone as long as the, you know, the company that builds it is still taking care of you.
Ara, what does that mean to you? Like when you think about a phone maker taking care of you, you know, we know companies are doing a slightly better job with updates, slightly better job with security patches. But what's your like minimum viable product for how long a phone should be updated?
So long as the apps that you use are getting updated and you're getting at least quarterly security updates, you're probably fine. My big thing for people hanging on to phones longer is phones seem to be lasting longer so long as you're buying something good at the get-go. Like my dad and my twin bought Pixel 3a XL. It was at Prime Day, and I'm hoping I don't have to deal with either of them buying a new phone for probably 3 years. Because now that they have a Pixel, I know it's going to get updated for 3 years. It's got a decent camera in it, and so long as it just doesn't just slow down to infinity in a year and a half, at which point I think they can just fix that by factory resetting it once, it shouldn't be an issue. Whereas my mom has a two-year-old Moto G5 S? No, Moto G5 Plus. Bought it at Mother's Day, but that froze up on her, like completely froze up on her yesterday, and she had to call Wagco tech support to help her get it back to working. And I'm like, okay, so I need to start looking at deals for her again.
So what's your hourly fee? Two Cokes and some, you know, money over Western Union or something?
Continued love.
I mean, they already gave me money for helping move into the new apartment, so I'm good for a while, so long as they can send me some more vanilla wafers, because my parents got me hooked on the Slatin Bakery vanilla wafers the last time I was in Texas, and they don't sell them here. And that's not fair. They can't hook me on things that I can only get at home.
Well, that's what the internet's for, but I digress. Sorry, Andrew.
I just think that Ara made a really good point there, that it depends on your starting point. You can't buy a $200 Moto G and expect it to be a 3-year phone in the same way that you can a, you know, OnePlus 7T today, you know, expecting that to last for 3 years. And obviously the Pixel 3a, 3a XL are on a slightly different level, because they really seem to outperform their starting price just to begin with at 400 or 480. But that floor of how good those phones are, it definitely has raised on the low end, but they're still low end phones, and you still do give up a lot of that long term prospect when you buy a $200 or $250 phone.
One other thing to consider here is if you look back at, you know, as recent as the iPhone 6 or the, you know, the last Nexus made by Huawei that I can't even remember the name
6P.
Of.
6P. So
yes. Look how really horrible the battery was 6 months after you bought them. That stopped happening. I don't know if there was a breakthrough in battery tech, but that was always a big reason to switch your phone, is because it didn't hold a charge anymore. And I think that's kind of gone away.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Well, I mean, batteries still degrade over 2 or 3 years. They just don't degrade in They just don't degrade as quickly anymore. And I think that has to do with a mixture between us making batteries bigger and us also having more battery improvements in the software.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that manufacturers are treating long-term battery health with a little bit more respect is a good thing, right? The fact that some manufacturers trickle charge the last 20%, or once they hit 50%, they drop down to like 2 or 3 watts if you're charging overnight. Like, these are things that prolong battery life in general, which is something I think every manufacturer should take more seriously as phones last 2, 3, 4 years. All right, let's move on. This one is similar, so I won't go. We won't spend too long on it. But Novahob wants to know, what's your view on upgrading your phone if you put yourselves in the general public shoes? I used to do it every year as tech moved so fast, but now it seems 2 to 3 years is the norm. I think reason phones are too expensive for small improvements, and they only need to get updates for the latest OS. You know, I wonder if I can reframe this a little bit. Thank you for that question. If phones are getting consistent platform updates 2 or 3 years, the expectation is that the hardware is good enough that the update won't tank that experience, right? It should improve in many ways the experience, whereas an older updates wouldn't.
How many phones are getting full OS updates for 2 years?
Not enough.
Because it's not that many.
No, but certainly more than there used to be. So, I don't know. I mean, Jerry, do you think that there's a technical reason behind this, that the floor of most hardware is so good now that it can withstand the impact of really kind of harsh software updates that often used to negatively affect performance?
I think that's part of it. I also think it's a smarter software management, and you know, you can get an update on your 2-year-old phone and, oh man, I didn't get this really cool feature, but that might be a good thing. You know, people that use Nexus phones or people that use iPhones can tell you that sometimes that last update you get really wrecks your phone and you wish you hadn't got it.
Yeah.
So I think they're being smarter about that and withholding things that just won't work great because the hardware maybe can't handle it well.
And not getting an OS update doesn't mean your phone isn't still secure, because now that we have the monthly patches for multiple versions of Android, even if they're like, okay, this probably isn't going to be work well on your phone, we're still going to give you the security updates if we're lucky.
Yeah, and that's true of, you know, I think also the scope of most platform updates has narrowed in recent years. So, you know, a lot of the big improvements were under the hood with Android 10, for instance. I haven't heard as many stories about Android 10 ruining performance on phones as I have with Android 9 and Android 8. So
It really helped my Pixel 3 XL, actually. Android 10 was like a big improvement in consistency and performance.
Wow, that's great. I didn't notice that as much, but I also didn't use the Pixel 3 that long on Android 10. I used the Pixel 3A a lot more, and that was basically the same. All right, let's move on. This question comes from Andy, and he wants to know, I'm interested in your takes on the best smallish, easy to hold Android phone I can buy. I'm still on the OG Pixel.
Another one.
Another OG Pixel. This is interesting. And it was holding its own, but started struggling on Android 10. I had pinned my hopes on the Pixel 4, but I'm tired of sacrificing battery performance and have eyed the Note 10 as unexpectedly small and just discovered the Galaxy S10e, which I'd ignored earlier this year. Any others I should consider?
I was going to recommend the Galaxy S10e.
Honestly, yeah, that's my answer. Too. I have that phone next to me right now. I just installed a security patch on it. It's still my favorite size for the price phone of 2019. It's amazing at what it does. And I really have no complaints.
It does all of the Galaxy S10 things, except for it has a flat screen, which is kind of a bonus. And the battery life is still good.
It has a capacitive battery, and it has a capacitive fingerprint sensor instead of that in-display nonsense.
Yeah.
So yeah, the S10e is the most dependable of the small phones to buy for that alone. It's got a headphone jack, it's got a good fingerprint sensor, and it's got good performance.
Uh-huh. And it's like $700, $750, something like that. I mean, it is expensive, you know, by kind of budget. I mean, the annoying thing there is that if you didn't care about size, you buy the OnePlus 7T for $100, $150 less, probably. But if you do care about that size, I think the S10e is a great pick.
Well, the S10e is also probably going to be one of those phones that it's like free with a 2-year activation at Black Friday.
Yeah, now that it's starting to get a little... If you can wait for the holidays, yeah, the whole S10 lineup is going to be on crazy discount.
I'm actually going to throw out another idea here. The Pixel 3A is amazing value. It's a really good small phone with way better battery life than the Pixel 4. And if you're coming from an OG Pixel, not only is the camera going to be a huge upgrade, but the performance itself will be a massive upgrade, even if it's still using a mid-range chip.
Yeah, if you do like that Pixel experience, that's a great choice.
Also, the Pixel 4A should be out sometime next year, but it's easier to justify the year-over-year upgrade if you're buying a $399 phone versus a $700-and-whatever-dollar phone. So that's my take. I think the Pixel 3A or the S10e would be the best choice for you right now.
I mean, if you've already paid for a second battery in your OG Pixel and the OG Pixel got Android 10, I feel like you should probably be able to hold out until the 4A.
Right. Although the OG Pixel is... I tried it with Android 10. I mean, I'm amazed it got updated. I think Google did a great thing keeping it up to date. But wow, is that thing brutal on Android 10. It just does not feel native at all.
It's a shame because the hardware is still really good.
All right, we're gonna move on. This is the Pixel 4 segment of the show. We got a bunch of questions about the Pixel 4, so we'll run through them. Firstly, Andy wants to know, this is a different Andy. Andy Mosley wants to know, will Google fix the battery issue with the Pixel 4? And then there's a kind of an addendum to that. Mike asks, why did Google put such a small battery in the Pixel 4? They must have known what would happen. I mean, we all knew. Did they know something we didn't or think something we didn't? We talked about this in previous episodes of the show, and it came down to the battery just being the only way that they could reduce size while or keep the size down while allowing the Soli hardware to fit inside the phone. Jerry, will Google fix the battery issue with the Pixel 4? I've heard this so many times. It's not possible, really, right?
Physics is not on their side.
Well, there's you have to, if you could take a Pixel 4 and shut off all the things that make it a Pixel phone, the battery might be pretty great. That's the only thing Google can do is send an update that kills a feature you might love, because that's the problem. You have so many things it's doing on such a small battery that that's what you get. And there's You can optimize it and maybe squeeze a tiny bit more out of it, but fix it? No, can't be done.
No, there's not something that they could just push out an update and magically it has 30% better battery life, because that's what it needs. It doesn't need, you know, it's not like on the cusp of having fine battery life. It needs a substantial improvement, and Google's not going to do that. Cause it can't get that much out of it without kind of just turning the thing into a brick. And you can obviously make the most of it on your own, but that also involves the same sort of, tightrope walk. You're going to be turning off, you know, everything. Basically, you're going to turn off your motion sense. You're going to turn off 90 hertz display. You're going to turn off ambient display. You're going to turn off all of these things and put it on battery saver, starting at 50% battery or whatever. And, you know, that's no way to live.
I forget the website, but there was this website that showed how manufacturers mess with background processes. And HMD was accused of being the most kind of like heavy-handed in just killing or preventing background processors from staying alive. This was the company's way of maintaining good battery life on phones with smaller battery cells. You know, Nokia did it the worst, and OnePlus did it as well. OnePlus has since changed, as has HMD. They're now just defaulting back to DOES, which is built into Android and should have been the default from the beginning. The question I have is, Google has spent so much time trying to fix these, we used to talk about wake locks, things that used to keep your phone awake when the screen was off or when it wasn't doing anything. We haven't heard about wake locks in a couple of years, and I think that's because Google did fix that specific problem. But there still is that sort of dead process or zombie process problem, where some apps just stay awake and keep using battery, even if, you know, you don't mean them to. How does that still happen on Android, Jerry?
Because developers don't care enough to fix their stuff. That's the blunt truth right there. If Google makes a change that makes your app run poorly, yes, that sucks. That's really, really a tough situation to be in, but it's still your app. And you have two choices. You can fix it, or you can let it go. Android used to be notorious for the way you were supposed to do things, made bad things happen if you're a developer. If Google took the time to fix most of that, you should take the time to update your app to take advantage of it.
Well, we all know how, you know, fast developers and how much developers care about updating their apps for newer APIs. So we actually have I got a really, really great email about that. We talked about it last week around the Pixel 4's facial recognition API. So if we have time at the end, I want to read that email because it's really enlightening. The next question about the Pixel 4, at what price point do you recommend? This is Matt. Matt asks, at what price point do you recommend the Pixel 4 XL? I'm on the fence due to the negativity around the phone, but I'm curious about where on this price spectrum do you recommend it? Andrew, I'll throw this at you because we know Pixels go discounted every year. They were discounted by $100 only a few days after they became available. What's your take?
I mean, everybody's decision is, you know, kind of factors in price differently. So I don't know, you know, how on the fence you are. I would say that there really isn't a whole lot of negativity to be thrown at the Pixel 4 XL except for the battery life. I mean, if you're really looking at it critically, you can pick apart any phone, obviously. You could pick apart the Galaxy S10 Plus or the OnePlus 7 Pro just as well. It's just going to be on different points.
I think you can pick apart a pack of pickled peppers.
I definitely couldn't do that. I don't have a problem with the price of it. It just really comes down to the battery life. It's like, can you put up with that? And honestly, you know, if you drop $200 off of it and it's $700, does it make the battery life any better? It just means it competes with different phones. It competes with the OnePlus 7 Pro at that point. It's going to be a while before it's consistently like $200 off. But that's the thing. If you care about the battery life that much, dropping the price is not going to fix the battery life. And for me, that's really the only problem with the only massive problem with the phone. And it's a big one, obviously. If your phone dies, it's not worth anything. So I have no problem with the price. And so I would, I recommend it right now. You just have to know what you're getting into with the battery.
I think, like, let's talk numbers for a second. $899 for the 64 gig Pixel 4 XL. It's not cheap. It's likely going to get discounted quite a lot over the next few months to $799, maybe $749. Perhaps early next year, we'll see it at $699. You know, brass tacks, like, is this a good phone at $700? Is it a better phone than the OnePlus 7T or the 7T or the 7 Pro, the Galaxy S10 Plus? Like, this is a phone that is in a very crowded market.
Yeah.
It's hard to say whether at what point it becomes the better deal or the better option.
I mean, obviously, the thing with the Pixel is, you know, the older it gets and the lower the price goes, the better the camera looks by comparison to the other phones that you're going to get at that price. And it's already its standout feature at the high end. And so when it gets cheaper, obviously, you start to compare it with other things. But like you said, the market is crowded, and it's not just crowded at $900. It's crowded at $800, $700, and $600, thanks to OnePlus. So it's not like it just completely fades the crowd when it drops by $200. We just got done talking about the Galaxy S10 series dropping in price over the holidays, as you know, fully expected. So it's not alone in its price drops. So that's why I don't like to kind of quibble over whether $100 makes a difference. It's you got to still look at the product as, you know, as a product and what it offers.
Do you have any takes on it, Ara, Jerry? I mean, neither of you actually have the phone, but
I have the small one. I'm on the small one right now, but for the Pixel 4 XL, I think it's a matter of you have to decide whether or not you want the phone, and if you want the phone, then yeah, we'll always take it for less money. But for $900, it's not bad, apart from the battery. And I mean, battery on every phone's going to suck after a year and a half anyway. You're just getting a head start on needing your battery pack as you go about your day.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, that's the thing. You have to build in that expectation and, you know, decide whether that is worth a certain amount of money or saving a certain amount of money.
I think every time you spend more than $500 on a phone, you encourage the manufacturer to make it more than $500 the next time. Don't do it.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the Pixel 4. We have a bunch of other questions, and we'll try to get through them. Last week, there was a rumor, or was it this week? I don't even remember, that Google is looking to acquire Fitbit. Earlier this summer, the news came out that Fitbit was looking for a buyer. This is a company. It's a public company. They have not had the amount of success that they thought they would have over the last few years, despite rebranding, or at least pivoting a little bit to smartwatches. They just launched Fitbit Premium, which is a monthly or annual subscription service that allows more personalized recommendations and coaching and all that. But you know, this is a company that is still only, quote, only worth a couple of billion dollars. It's chump change to a company like Amazon or Google. Now we know that Google is looking to buy Fitbit. So that's the context for Hari's question. What are the chances of Google rebranding Fitbit if the acquisition is successful? Ara, I would love to know what you think of Fitbit as a company and whether it fits into this idea of like Google acquiring tech companies and try to integrate them into its existing platforms.
If Google bought Fitbit, the best thing they could do is just fold Google Fit into Fitbit and then try to get their fitness tracking on Wear OS up to a halfway decent standard. But at the same time, I feel like this is one of those things of if Google bought Fitbit, no matter what they did, they would be seen as having ruined the company.
Yeah.
Like Google hasn't been able to do Fitbit well yet, and I don't think they're going to start now.
So Jerry, you wrote an editorial about how buying Fitbit could potentially save Wear OS from certain Doom. I find that intriguing. I respectfully disagree. I do. But I find it intriguing, and I would love to hear you elaborate on that.
When you say smartwatch, you really only mean one thing. You mean the Apple Watch. Yes, there are people buying Wear OS watches, and there are a lot of people buying Samsung's offerings, but a smartwatch is, if you look at numbers, it's Apple Watch and then also RAN. And that's a problem if you're not Apple. And you have to look at why people are buying smartwatches. Yes, there are a lot of people who want to be able, oh, I can show my boarding pass, or, you know, I can get my calendar on the go. But I think the biggest segment is, right now anyway, is fitness. Even Apple realizes that fitness is very important. They've partnered with Nike, and it made their product better and more appealing to a lot of people. That's what Google needs, is something that will make their product more appealing to more people. And if you're going to go with the fitness path to do that, an acquisition of Fitbit is the perfect way to start. That's a company, it's a name that maybe they don't have a lot of sales, but you look at the people that have them, minor gripes aside about how poor the app might be on their phone or whatever, they love the product. They love the way it keeps track of what it's supposed to keep track of. That's not something you hear a lot of for people that, you know, buy a Wear OS watch for fitness. And that's, I think, really one of Google's paths to success. And maybe it won't be successful, but there's just not a lot of options left out there. I think this is one of the best things that Google could do if they want to continue to have a smartwatch ecosystem of any sort.
I agree that it's a good move. Who knows if it can actually, you know, put them over any sort of a, you know, any sort of a hurdle to get them back into, you know, public consciousness, or it, you know, I guess as if Wear OS was ever in the public consciousness to any real degree, but Fitbit definitely is. And so with how valuable that brand is, it would be a shame to see it acquired just for its IP and its talent, and you kind of let that brand die, because the brand is so valuable. But it would also require a ton of investment from Google's side as well, because that can't, you know, you can't just take Fitbit's knowledge on, you know, casual fitness tracking and integrate it into Wear OS and call it a day. Like, this would need to be a full new product launch.
Also, if Google were to buy Fitbit out and do it right, you could buy a fashion smartwatch that does fitness well. You could buy a sport, you know, fitness tracking watch that you're used to, or you could maybe even buy a luxury brand smartwatch that can still do fitness well. That really bumps the options up.
Right. They bought HTC's engineers for what? Just over $2 billion?
I thought it was like 1.2, something like that. Lots of money.
A lot of money, more money than a lot of people thought. $1.1 billion. This was back in early 2018. We now know that Taiwan business went on to produce the Pixel 3a. It seems like it was a decent acquisition, or at least a decent investment. We know that, earlier this year, they spent $40 million for some of Fossil's technology. So just to put that into perspective, Fitbit today, as I'm talking, is worth $1.56 billion. That's the current market cap based on a share price of $6. The share has actually risen quite a lot in the last couple of days. The 52-week low was $2.81. That came in August. That was off a five-year high of just over $50, just under $50. So this is a company that went from basically owning the fitness wearable space to almost going, they still have a fair amount of market share and more so mind share. Everybody knows Fitbit. The brand
definitely
is really valuable.
Share.
But once the Apple Watch debuted in 2015, the stock tanked. I mean, we're talking, it went from just under $50 in mid-2015 down to $12 by March of 2016. That is a huge drop.
So they got ripped apart from both sides because Apple took all of the casual users on iPhone that, you know, wanted to get a little bit more, wanted something nicer, and also just, you know, better integrated. And then they got taken out at the high end by companies like Garmin that do a dedicated fitness platform so much better. And it's kind of the same story as Wear OS, actually, because Wear OS sits in that middle ground where it doesn't, you know, do the deep integration stuff very well. And the app platform is basically non-existent. And then it also doesn't do the high-end fitness stuff.
We also have to remember around that time when the stock started dropping in December of 2015, there were a bunch of controversies and scandals around Fitbit causing rashes on people's wrists.
Yeah.
People had reactions to the materials Fitbit was using. So the stock, the company took a huge hit and has never really recovered from that. So, you know, they've been under $8 since 2017, and they've just kind of coasted since. So anyway, it's an interesting idea. I'm interested in learning how Google would integrate Fitbit, but honestly, buying them for a couple billion dollars would be really not a huge deal for Google, and it could potentially provide a lot of data, the kind of data that Google takes very, very seriously, as well as just the millions of Fitbit users that the company still has. So that's a great idea. But sorry, Jerry, yeah.
The best reason to buy Fitbit is so Microsoft or Amazon doesn't buy Fitbit.
Right. It would be, more of a defensive move than anything else. All right, so the next question is from Missy, and this one is similar to the last one. I currently have a Fitbit Versa, and I'm thinking of switching to a Wear OS watch. I have a Pixel 3 XL, and I'm not a huge Samsung fan, so she's not looking into getting a Galaxy watch, whatever. It would have light use, but I want to be able to respond to texts with it, maybe a little Google Assistant usage, some fitness tracking. What do you recommend? Andrew, can you recommend Wear OS at all for those things right now?
Yeah, it's a real shame that Missy says that she's not a huge Samsung fan because their wearables are really good. I like what she's asking for right there is like Galaxy Watch Active, Galaxy Watch Active 2. Like they're made well, they're attractive looking watches that you could swap out the bands on. They're actually considerably cheaper than what you would spend on one of the nicer looking Wear OS watches. You may be overestimating how useful Google Assistant can be on your wrist because it's not. And you can respond to texts on a Samsung watch the same way you can respond to texts on a Wear OS watch. So unless you're really looking for the variety, like the big thing that Wear OS provides is variety of design and sizes and brands. And if that matters to you, like that's really where Wear OS shines. But if not, like really don't look past getting a Galaxy Watch Active or Watch Active 2 if you want GPS. Because what she explains there that she's looking for really does kind of align with what Wear OS can do, like really sticking to the basics. And if you care about the design and style more, which is, you know, very important because it's a watch, then yeah, I can recommend Wear OS for that. But functionality-wise, like, don't skip over Samsung.
She's talking about responding to a bunch of notifications, and I have to say, I don't really like the way that notifications are handled on the Galaxy Watch Active, which is what I'm wearing right now with my Pixel 4. But
yeah, same.
I much prefer the way that notifications are handled on Wear OS, and I much prefer the way that music is handled on Wear OS, because it's easier to set it as a watch face, and it's easier to access it and change it. And to that degree, I have been using Tick watches for a while. The E2 is probably good enough for her without breaking the bank. But the, what was the Fossil watch that had all the colors a couple of months ago? The Fossil Sport?
Fossil Sport.
That one would probably also be a good fit
also
for her.
Also affordable.
If the fifth gen wasn't available.
I agree with that.
I know a couple people that have a Wear OS watch, and they have the Skagen watch, both of them. They love it.
Oh, yeah, the Falster, too.
It's a good-looking watch.
It looks good. It's supposed to have really good battery life. And it's not the cheapest model available, but it's not like the price of one of the Montblanc or, you know, Movado watches. It's still affordable, quote-unquote. So that would be my only recommendation because I'm not really exposed to them.
So my one caveat here is that I would recommend a Wear OS watch, but only one that has a gig of RAM. So only ones that are based on the Fossil Gen 5 platform. The watches that I've used, like even the Fossil Sport, that only have 512 or 768 megs of RAM, just they tank. They tank for performance, and I don't think that they're worth investing. If you're going to go Wear OS, I would make sure that you do something like the TicWatch Pro 4G, which has a gig of RAM, or any of the Fossil Gen 5s. They're a bit more expensive, but the performance gain is real. I actually think Wear OS is usable now. I'm enjoying using it, and I agree that for notification triage, especially for things like responding to texts, Wear OS is still better than Tizen, and certainly better than Fitbit. Fitbit's platform as a smartwatch is just not very good. So yeah, that's my take on it.
Speaking of Wear OS watches, I actually had a question myself real quick. What does everybody think of the new Moto 360?
Next.
Looks like another Wear OS watch.
I don't quite understand it. I think Motorola is just doing, or Lenovo is doing anything it can to get some of those license dollars. But yeah, I don't understand it.
I thought it looked nice.
But it looks nice because the Moto 360 looked nice, not because there's anything new there, right?
I don't need it to be new. I just need it to look pretty and work properly.
Then don't buy a smartwatch. Buy a really nice watch.
But a really nice watch can't control my music or see who in Slack just pinged me while I'm walking around Epcot.
Neither will that one after you've had it on for 2 hours and the battery's dead.
Yeah, I think it looks nice, but it's like it is just another Wear OS watch. It's kind of the same discussion.
It's $350.
Missed opportunity. Should be $360. They could have made another $10.
With tax in some states, yeah. It would be $360. You know, it's the same. I don't get it. It's basically identical to, it looks like the TicWatch, you know, C, what's it called?
The S2 or the C2?
The C2, right? It has the two buttons. Yeah, it's fine. I'm sure
there are lots of other good looking Wear OS watches. That's the thing.
It looks fine. All right, let's move on. So this is the RCS portion of the show. A lot of questions around RCS. It's been in the news lately because for two reasons. One, the U.S. carriers recently came together to basically undermine Google's RCS intentions by forming a committee called the CCMI. And this is basically a way for all the four U.S. carriers to create a RCS-powered text platform or text solution that doesn't actually conform to the way that Google wants to do it. You know, I find it frustrating that this is happening, especially since Google is just now getting its stuff together. So the question is from Dexter Cumberbatch. Hello. Will Google finally get a true iMessage competitor? And then I'm going to add this, add to that JR Sharp 70's message of why won't native RCS get end-to-end encryption? What is the best way to send messages without Google or carrier scanning them for ads? Is my option really invasion of privacy or iOS? So both of those are related. Jerry, will Google ever get a true iMessage competitor?
Google doesn't want an iMessage competitor.
I don't think it has. I don't think it can, not in the same way.
That's not how Android or Chrome or Google's other smart platforms, that's not how that works. iMessage is only... You know, I'll use the word popular or good interchangeably here because of how well it's integrated with the ecosystem that Apple has created. Yes, you can strip iMessage out of the iPhone and you could slap it on an Android phone, but then you don't have the iMessage store. You don't have the emojis. You don't have all the other things that people love about iMessage. It won't work with your Chromebook. It won't work with your Windows laptop. It's only good because it works so well in Apple's ecosystem. End-to-end encryption, is my only option invasion of privacy or iOS? Well, if that's what you're going to say, then iOS is not your option.
Yeah.
Because iOS is only encrypted on one out of every 19 phones in the world. For the rest, Apple is stuck using SMS. If you're really worried about invasion of privacy, you use Signal.
Yeah, you shouldn't be on iMessage in the first place there, because ultimately
iMessage is fully end-to-end encrypted,
but only to other iMessage users, which are
it ultimately will fall back to SMS, and you don't want to accidentally fall back to SMS in a, like, if you're that worried. I mean, you can argue about whether or not you should be that worried about your privacy with your messages, but you need to pick a messaging platform which the only option is
right.
And it's is fully encrypted, and you don't have any other choice. Like it's the only way you could send that message, and it's separate from your phone.
Not knocking iMessage here. I think for almost everyone, that's good enough. If everybody you talk to uses iMessage, your conversations are encrypted, and when your bank has to text you something stupid, that's not encrypted. But so what? That's good enough security. But if you're concerned enough to say, is my only option really invasion of privacy or iOS, then no, your only option is Signal at this point. A lot of people will say Telegram, but there's been some news around Telegram, and I think the Russian mafia of all things, just stick with Signal. Everybody has audited that code and loves Signal. There you go. There's your answer.
But that kind of brings up a good point, though, is good luck getting all of your friends and family to start using Signal. Like that's kind of the other side of why an iMessage competitor is so appealing as an idea, because iMessage just happens. You send a message to another person on an iPhone, and then you just have this rich text chat, group chat, media, all this stuff kind of just happens. Whereas Signal, it's like, yeah, I'm not going to get my mom to use Signal. Like, it's just not going to happen. Nor do I really care about having those messages encrypted, of course, but like that's why this discussion over RCS and iMessage and cross-platform is so appealing to people.
For an iMessage competitor, it's also, oh yeah, it's great. Everybody's going to be locked into this the second that you message somebody with that. And then it's like, oh yeah, but I'm stuck here forever, because getting all of your crap out of iMessage is next to impossible. And for SMS, I mean, it's easy to convert those over.
So the question, okay, I think it's interesting that we're talking about this because we have to give it a U.S. versus the rest of the world context, as Jerry said, right? Only 19% of people in the world use Apple, use iOS devices, but 50 or more than 50% of people in the U.S. use iMessage. And most people, or many people, especially young people, send exclusively iMessages to one another. They're not thinking about the fact that it's end-to-end encrypted. I think it's important that, RCS provides the same functionality, at least similar functionality to iMessage in an app that most people are already using for texting. And I think, this wasn't explicitly the question, but what's frustrating to me is that with the CCMI announcement, which is going to force customers to use a separate app, it just undermines the idea that one app, namely Google Messages, is the place that RCS lives on Android. Now, that's never going to be something that we can, rely on, because most people with an Android phone have a Samsung phone, and those phones ship with Samsung Messages. But yep, even Samsung Messages supports RCS. So I guess the question is, what is Google's ultimate goal here? It's just trying to lower the bar for seamless IP-based messaging on any Android phone.
Right. It's not trying to be the be-all, end-all, best go-to chat platform. It's tried to do that so many times, it's completely failed. RCS is going to provide it with provide the lowest common denominator, you know, SMS, you know, or I should say phone number based chat with really good features. It's not going to make it the go-to chat platform. It's just not going to get to that point. And if it does, it's going to be 10 years from now. And you don't need to sit around and tap your toe waiting for that to happen. There are other good messaging apps you can use.
I don't want to gloss over J.R. Sharp asked, why won't native RCS get end-to-end encryption? It probably will. It doesn't have it right now because it's still just a theory right now. If you're in the United States and you use Sprint and you talk to another person that's using Sprint and you use Android messages, you're using RCS.
That's like seven people.
Yeah. Other than that, unless you're have hacked in this latest thing and are using a testing sandbox server for RCS that could disappear at any time, RCS is just not really in use. It's spotty. And I mean, there's some in Europe, there are a few carriers that have enabled some of it or all of it. It's not widely used enough yet to even iron the bugs out of it. End-to-end encryption would be, I don't want to use the word easy, but it's something that they could tack on to what's there. You have to just get everybody on the same page first, and that's what they're trying to do.
Right. So, I mean, end-to-end encryption for some people is more important than others. I think, it's a matter, like biometrics on a phone, it's a balance of security versus right. convenience, and iMessage provides both. It provides a secure way to send messages to other iPhone users that's also very convenient. RCS, if it's done right, RCS is invisible. It just turns from SMS to chat. You know, if I'm sending Jerry a text and we're both using an RCS supported client and both phone numbers are registered with our carriers as supporting RCS or whatever, Google, you know, we've used this Google hack to opt in. It should just change from text to chat, and I can send higher quality photos and get read write receipts and all the benefits that come with RCS. But it's not a Google wants it to be as seamless as iMessage, but unfortunately the network effect just is not there, and it won't be there for a long time. So that's my problem with it.
Google could grow a spine and just say no. There's no more choosing your messaging app. If you want to use Android with the name Android, you have to use messages for, you know, the SMS client on the phone you build and tell the carriers that this is, you know, we're enabling our RCS servers and we're going to hijack every single SMS. And if any of you in the chain don't like it, tough. But that'll never happen, but it could happen.
Well, we wouldn't want that to happen. I mean, there are plenty of third-party SMS apps out there.
No, we want that to happen. The only reason iMessage is so good is because everybody with an iPhone has to use it.
Right.
If you had 100 choices for texting apps on the iPhone and only iMessage had the features that iMessage has, half the people you know would be using something that has a feature they think is really cool and would not have the iMessage experience. iMessage works so well because every single user on that platform is using the exact same code base. And that's how you have to start.
But WhatsApp is another example yes. of this, where network effect has built it into the most powerful, you know, isolated or at least private messaging platform in the world. The Chilean government said that it was going to start taxing WhatsApp, and that's what prompted the riots in Santiago. I mean, obviously it was more than that, but that's what started it. This notion that people would have to pay a tax on using WhatsApp because it's so ubiquitous. This WhatsApp recently took a stand against a hack that was being used that purportedly came from what's it called, NSO, the Israeli that Israel-based private kind of like hacking company.
The scary guys that are really good. I know who you mean.
Yeah, the NSO group. So the WhatsApp actually sued them for allowing cyber attacks on its users by finding zero-day vulnerabilities within the code, and obviously NSO sells those zero days to the highest bidder rather than reporting them to companies like WhatsApp. They do the same thing for Apple. They've done the same thing for Android. But WhatsApp, you know, the whole idea about WhatsApp, I mean, you can talk about the controversy, you know, about the fact that it's owned by Facebook. But at the end of the day, WhatsApp is still a private end-to-end encrypted platform that has never been hacked. So this is something that's a big deal, and it's a good thing that WhatsApp is suing NSO Group for for allowing or facilitating malware on the platform, especially in vulnerable countries where, you know, dissidents are hunted down and arrested. And they use WhatsApp to hide from the government.
You can't take take the risk of sending a regular SMS. It's just, you can't do that.
Right. So, I mean, this was an accusation that the NSO facilitated malware on phones of at least 100 human rights defenders, journalists, and other members of civil society across the world. These are the people that are trying to hold truth to power, and basically, the governments used these NSO, you know, vulnerabilities to find out who these dissidents were. So that's a problem, and that is one of the reasons why end-to-end encryption is so important, and the reason that what RCS is a non-starter for a lot of people, you know, that transmit secure messaging is because at the end of the day, if a government wants to see a message passed over RCS, they can see it. They could pass it along. They can compel the carrier to pass that along. We know that that's not true of end-to-end encrypted platforms.
But I think that's why you have to separate the two for now. That, you know, you can't... iMessage isn't only great because it offers end-to-end encryption between iPhones. WhatsApp is not only great because it offers end-to-end encryption between WhatsApp users. They're a great platform that have the features people love, and they work really well. They also offer end-to-end encryption for the few people that actually need it and the lot more people that really want it. But that's not what makes them successful or desirable.
Right, right, for sure. Okay, so let's quickly talk about... biometrics. So Albert sent us an email, Albert Wilcox, a regular listener of the show, about how he's a happy user of the S9 Plus, and he's not really interested in the you know, under the glass fingerprint sensors found in the S10. You know, what's the future of biometrics on smartphones, right? Like, Google has put its foot down, so has Apple, around facial recognition, facial unlock. But, you know, Samsung seems to be wavering or at least waffling on things. You know, they got rid of the iris scanner in the Galaxy S10 series, ostensibly because the under-the-glass fingerprint solution was better. But it wasn't. It hasn't been better.
Well, it didn't take up as much room, so that was kind of the big win there.
But also that, you know, they advertised that it was the same experience or better, that it was a good solution and that it was seamless, but we know now that that's not true. So what comes next? Does Samsung just continue to iterate on under-the-glass fingerprint sensors that, you know, we know now have been pretty... you know, hit or miss for a lot of users? Or does it also go the route of facial recognition eventually moving to something like Google or Apple or Huawei?
I think that Samsung is going to do at least one more generation of fingerprint, and hopefully the next gen of what Qualcomm puts together for in-display fingerprint is improved, and you got to hope that it would be, or they go with something else like what OnePlus is using, one of the new optical sensors. But I just don't think that Samsung wants to give way and go back to a larger top bezel to get what's necessary in there to be able to do proper secure face unlock. And I think that they're probably going to be just waiting it out to see if they can get more of those sensors underneath the display before they switch.
Well, what about putting them on the side like they did with the S10e?
Going back to an extra, I mean for a for the switch to face unlock in particular. I don't think that they care that much about going to a side. I mean, a side mounted fingerprint involves more hardware issues than the
right.
than the trade off for the experience issue. They're actually probably okay with the trade off of in display fingerprint right now, especially when you know that the next generation will be better.
So I guess the question is, will eventually everybody move to this understanding? You know, Google has talked about ambient computing a lot, and facial recognition is a major part of that. This idea that you really don't have to do anything, you don't have to action at all. It just works. Now, that hasn't come without controversy. Namely, there is a big security liability around the need to be able to look at your phone, or being having the option to have your eyes open in order for the facial recognition to unlock. And also, the software just wasn't ready, and there aren't enough apps that support this new biometric prompt API. But in a year, 2 years, when all of those things are fixed, will everybody else catch up and acknowledge that this is the better way?
Define better. That's where you have to start. I think that facial recognition, the way Apple and Google and possibly Huawei, I haven't really been able to play too much with Huawei's option, but I think that is the most security-based. You know, that's the best deal you've got right now. It's pretty secure, and it's really fast if done right. That's the two, that's the requirements. It needs to be, I like to say secure enough, but it needs to be more than secure enough. It needs to be actually secure if that's what you want, and it needs to work reasonably fast. And that's very difficult to do. And I think Apple and Google have both done a great job making that happen. Right. I don't see Samsung ever being able to do that unless Google offers it. Here's a package, install these sensors, install this software, and it just works. I don't ever see Samsung being able to make this happen on their own. They do a lot of things really well. That sort of innovation, doing the unknown is not something Samsung is great at. They can take an idea, hardware-based. Look at the Note series. That's a great example. Or look what they've done with PC monitors. Something Samsung is amazing at doing. But pulling an idea out of thin air and making it work and work really well is not their strong point. I think, though, that Google is probably going to do that. Let OEMs install these parts, and this is how it will work. And like Andrew said, eventually all this stuff will be able to work through the glass. And when that happens, Samsung's going to be all over it, and it's going to be great.
Yeah, I guess the question is, that action, do you want biometrics to be active or passive? And is the aspiration for manufacturers to eventually remove any friction at all from authentication?
It is for Google. I forget what year it was, but 1 year at I.O., I sat in on one of the sessions, and I only got in at the last half, and I wish I hadn't. The next big thing is ambience, as in sound. The sound of your voice is going to be biometrics. And I was really intrigued. Apparently, right now, they have simple computers and software. The sound of your voice is more distinct than a fingerprint or even your iris.
Right.
And that's what Google's aims are, is your phone just knows it's around you. It knows it's in your hand. It knows, by the way your hand moves, by the way you walk, the sounds it can hear. And when you've got it in your hand, it's unlocked. When you set it on the table, it's locked.
Right. Yeah. That's, I mean, ultimately, I think that's the way to go. It uses more than just your, you know, your biometrics, but we're not quite there yet.
No, no. I think this is probably 10 years off.
Okay. Let's move on. So two questions, one from Nick and one from Aegis. Aegis, I don't know how to pronounce that. One says, should we wait for the new Pixel Buds? And the other says, thoughts on the Pixel Buds 2? I know only Andrew and I have actually seen them in person. We were able to go to the New York-based launch event, and in it feels like forever ago, but it wasn't. It was only 2 weeks ago. And my immediate take was that Google did a good thing skipping a year. These are completely different products. Despite the same name, they are built from, you know, I hate the expression, but they're built from the ground up. They have no relation at all to the original Pixel Buds other than sharing the same name.
And that's a good thing.
It's a really good thing. Because especially with this week's announcement of the AirPods Pro, the bar is so high for true wireless earbuds now that if Google didn't nail this, there would be no coming back from it. There's no third time's a charm in this industry. So there are three things that I really like about this. One, the design is fantastic, but they also don't look like AirPods, right?
And the case design is good too.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Like they're small. The case is, it's white and it flips open. So maybe there's a little bit of a comparison to the AirPods, but like it does look very googly. And the earbud design, more importantly, is just great. They seem like they fit really well in the ear. There's a lot of cool stuff happening from a technical perspective, which is something that most other companies can't claim. And generally, I just think that Google is taking a pretty straightforward approach. They want these to sound really good. They want the battery to last a long time. And they want the user experience to be as good on Android as AirPods are on an iPhone.
And if the dynamic equalization and noise cancellation works as expected, you know, big asterisk, that's it looks like a great complete package.
Do you know what really impressed me about the Pixel Buds? And you know, I haven't seen them. There are two ways to tackle any problem, a difficult way and an easy way. Google has always been the company that goes the difficult way. If you're riding a bicycle, you need to be able to hear what's around you. If you're wearing Pixel Buds, the typical Google way would have been to have an array of microphones that are positioned in a 360-degree sphere around you that pick up all ambient noise and then translate it from audio, you know, or from, you know, digital to analog so you can hear a car horn, which, yeah, I guess. But instead, these just have a small airport. There's a hole. And if there's a car behind you, you can hear it. That sometimes simple is genius. And I really like that.
Right.
I don't. That means that no matter what I do, some noise from the outside is going to be able to get in pretty easily.
No, it doesn't.
And
if they generate the right white noise tone, you won't hear anything.
If.
If. Right. If. It doesn't necessarily mean
we have to wait until spring to find out. But I think that, you know, Google has positioned itself for success in a way that the Pixel Buds never could, the originals, because they came out a year after the original AirPods were announced. So they were already at a disadvantage by not being true wireless. The design obviously just killed it. But, even at the announcement, they were at a disadvantage. So now they're on a level playing field. They don't have ANC, active noise cancellation, but, you know, there does seem to be a fair bit of passive isolation. And overall, I just think these are going to be a win, especially since they're 180 and the Pixel and the AirPods Pro are 250. They're not cheap, but they're certainly not the most expensive. Okay, moving on. These are two quick ones, both sort of about OnePlus. Brian926 asks, I'd really like to purchase a OnePlus 6T or 7T for my wife and I. We're on Verizon, and I've read that at this time, those phones will activate an LTE-only mode. Can you explain what this means and what functionality is lost by activating in this mode? Jerry, this is an interesting question because it speaks to Verizon's move away from CDMA, away from 3G, and a reliance entirely on VoLTE or voice over LTE in markets where that's supported, which I think is almost everywhere now, except for like very rural areas. Talk about this, because this is something that will have to happen with Verizon, but also if T-Mobile and Sprint merger ever goes through, that'll have to happen with Sprint as well.
I think if you're a Verizon customer, yeah, you're pretty safe getting an LTE-only phone. Roaming is the only time that you really might have an issue, you know, by losing the CDMA radios. But other carriers, I wouldn't be so bullish on that. To Brian's question, I think he would be fine with LTE-only phone on Verizon. Sprint and T-Mobile, that's a whole other mess. It's luckily, most of the phones sold by Sprint or to work with Sprint also will work just fine on, you know, on T-Mobile's network. The real trick is to getting it a seamless handoff so it works, you know, in areas where Sprint coverage is better, and it also works where T-Mobile's coverage is better without you having to push any buttons or have 5 minutes of downtime while it switches between networks. I assume they've got that figured out, but it's never safe to assume.
Right. Okay, next question is about 5G. So Zach asks, for the first time in a while, I'm happy to hold on to my current phone, which is a OnePlus 6T, for longer than a year. I'm looking ahead at what would get me to upgrade, and I'm thinking 5G. With T-Mobile saying their 5G network will reach 200 million people by the end of the year, do you think upgrading to the OnePlus 7T Pro McLaren Edition for its 5G radios would be a good logical next step?
Say it, Daniel. Just come out and say it.
No. It is not worth it, not in 2019 and probably not in 2020. So, Zach, here's what I'm going to say. There's a couple of advantages to the McLaren Edition that no other phone has. It's the first and only phone in the U.S. to use the Qualcomm Snapdragon X55 modem, which means that it natively supports 600 megahertz on 5G. It can seamlessly switch between 5G and 4G in a way that the X50 could not. It is a much more power efficient chip, and it will probably last through 2020. However, I don't think it's worth putting any money into 5G yet, especially since if you're in an urban area where T-Mobile's network is good, you're probably not going to notice huge gains.
And you can just get the 7 Pro.
Yeah, you can get the 7 Pro unless you really value that weird McLaren edition like etching on the back and the orange colors. And if you read Harish's really, really hilarious review of the McLaren edition, you can see that even him, a huge McLaren fan, did not appreciate the changes made to the design this year. So yeah, I would recommend waiting until the end of next year for the second generation of 5G phones to come out and just skip this year entirely.
Everything T-Mobile says about its network right now, there's probably a little asterisk at the end of the sentence in the press release, and you go down to the bottom and it will have a big long explanation about the Sprint merger. T-Mobile's 5G network reached 200 million people. Maybe not, because their network right now, it's in a fixed position. Any future plans really depend on how they integrate with Sprint, and this what they think versus reality may not be the same. I think if you're a T-Mobile customer and you're happy with the way it works now, it's not going to get any worse, but don't count on having 5G.
Yep.
So Zach has a follow-up question that I just want to run by you, Jerry. He asks, how is 5G on 600 megahertz faster than 4G on 600 megahertz? They're using the same waves, so does the new standard introduce something new?
I don't know that it's going to be any faster. 5G depends on the bandwidth. 600 megahertz has a fixed amount of bandwidth. I'm not sure how much of that LTE on 600 megahertz is able to use or is using. Maybe 5G technology can use more, maybe a wider path and use more bandwidth that would make it, you know, faster, quote unquote.
Yeah. How it's being deployed matters significantly.
But they are using the same waves. Does the new standard introduce something new? Yes, it's more efficient ways to use a wider swath of the spectrum. So it could be faster, but like I said, I don't know that I've heard that it will be faster. What it offers is, you know, a more on the hardware and deployment side. It's going to be better, but better doesn't always equal faster.
I want to just bring something that our friend of the pod, Sasha Segan, wrote about low band 5G. You know, he's the, you know, main analyst of, you know, at PC Mag. He's been covering 5G for a very long time. What he says is that inherently 5G is about 20 to 30% more efficient than 4G, which means that if you're using the same amount of bandwidth with the same spectrum, you're able to get between 20 and 30% faster speeds just by upgrading. That doesn't mean you're going to. I mean, there's a lot of factors involved, including the node capacity and the equipment used and your phone and you know, your distance from the node and things like that. But on low band, where spectrum is basically all used, right? There's no new 600 megahertz right. spectrum being found. The rollout is very similar, at least right now, to the way that 4G is used at that spectrum. You're going to see the same, if only slightly better speeds. But what he's saying is that you'll benefit from lower latency, which is something that, you know, LTE for its benefits is still pretty bad at.
Right.
And generally there are more integrations with the Internet of Things, but that will not really affect consumers. It'll affect businesses and industry. So that's really where you benefit from low band 5G right now.
So I was almost right.
No, you were right. You were right. Yeah. But it's inherently 5G is more efficient, but the real benefits from 5G come with the fact that it supports mid and high band spectrum where LTE will never support it. And that mid and high band spectrum, you're right. talking about hundreds and hundreds of megahertz, which will allow those gigabit speeds.
And it's still going to be able to use the 4G spectrum that it has now for times it doesn't need 5G. The 5G is not, it's very different than what we think of and what we're using now. And it's different in a lot of good ways.
Okay. So we're moving into the sort of the less formal part of the show. So we'll try to run through these pretty quickly. Y2Whisper asks, what's been your favorite tech gadget that you've used in 2019? We'll just go around. Jerry, what's your favorite gadget so far this year?
I'm going to have to go with the Pixel 3 because it's the first time that I can use a phone for an actual camera for just about everything. The Pixel 2 was close. The Pixel 3 made it a reality. So I don't have to worry about being out somewhere and seeing a picture I could use for work or just a picture of something I want to see. And, oh, man, I don't have my camera because my phone will take a picture that's 95% as good as any camera that I could afford.
All right. What's your favorite gadget of 2019?
Shield. I am just still in love with my 2015 Shield TV, and I really want to play with the new ones.
Interesting. So it's like you use your Shield enough that it is your favorite.
Yeah, I mean, I use that like multiple hours every day. That's the only, what's plugged into my living room TV. So that's what I use for YouTube. That's what I use for Netflix. That's what I use for Crunchyroll and Funimation. That's what I'm going to use for Disney Plus for hours and hours on end.
All right.
And yeah, using that with the 2017 controller is just easier for browsing through YouTube videos and trying to find that one episode of that one show that I want to watch right now.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough.
I can't argue with Era. The Shield is an amazing device.
Andrew, what's your favorite gadget of 2019?
I'm on the fence on a few things, but in terms similar to Ara, in terms of like just something that is not brand new, but is just an integral part of every single day, is my Bose QC35 headphones. I wear these things for, I'm wearing them right now. I wear these things for an average of 5 hours a day, something like that. I've replaced the ear cups on them several times because I wear them so much. It's one of those things that like, not the newest product, but it does exactly what I need it to do. And they're so, so comfortable that if these broke today, I would immediately buy another brand new pair without even thinking about it.
Right.
It's like very few products are on that level for me.
So mine is similar, and it's not a new product. It didn't even come out in 2019, but I got them in 2019. So I'm going to say that they're my favorite. It's the Jabra Elite 65T True Wireless Earbuds.
Yeah.
They are, you know, I've used basically every pair of True Wireless Earbuds released in the last 2 years. These are the ones I come back to every single time. They are, you know, yeah, they have micro USB charging and the case is a little bit chunky and not as nice as the AirPods or some of the others, but they sound great. They work independently or together. They connect immediately to all of my devices. I never have Bluetooth issues, and they just work. And I have used them more than I think any other product I own this year. They're always the, you know, I take Zadie for a walk multiple times a day. They're always the one I leave by the front door so that I can just grab them and go. And it just comes down to the fact that like some products transcend the review cycle and they just become a regular part of your life. And for me, that's the Jabra Elite 65Ts, which is why I'm so excited for the 75Ts, which were supposed to be released in October. And we're recording this on October 31st, and they are still coming soon.
They've got a couple
really,
hours.
Really mad. Maybe, yeah, maybe they'll show up at my door and just surprise me. All right, let's move on. Steve asks three questions, and I'm hoping that we can get to all of them, but maybe not. He asks, do you actually still enjoy using the phones that you get despite the constant need to switch to a new review device every day, week, month? Andrew, you probably use more phones than any of us, so yeah. I'll start with you.
The switching part is a pain, and that's actually, it's kind of a good indicator when we go to think about these phones after the initial review period is, like, it's a good indicator for us if we don't want to switch away from the phone. If, like my Pixel 4 XL, I finish the review and I keep using the phone, like that's a really good sign. Or if I finish a review and I just, as soon as I'm done with that, I take the SIM out and I go to something else, like that's also an important sign for that phone. So you learn, you learn a lot about how much you really care about the phones when you have access to pretty much any phone you want, which one you end up landing on. And so it's like, it does inform what we write about and what our picks are when we talk about, you know, recommending these things. But sometimes I really do wish that I could just stay on one phone for more than a couple weeks. That'd be great.
What about you guys?
I mean, this is the first year I've really had to change any significant amount, because this was the first year that I actually got an S10, a Pixel 3a, and then the Note 10 Plus, and now the Pixel 4. So this is the first time I've had to change phones more than twice in a year. And yeah, I kind of wish I could just pick one and settle for a while, but I think I'm going to do that for the Pixel 4 for everything, but like watching videos while I'm cleaning my new apartment that doesn't have internet yet. Because I like having the big storage on the Note 10, but I need a Pixel for Wi-Fi calling.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't change. I use two different carriers. I have my phone that's my phone, and it's got my phone number on it. And that's what I use until I think I need something new. And then I have another phone that's for work stuff. And I don't care about it.
You're the most stable of all of us, Jerry. And that's why we love you.
A little bit of inside baseball. I complained for years about having to review phones. I cannot stand it. It's just something, part of this job, that I don't like to do. And I think I complained enough that I don't have to do it much anymore, which is awesome. So
no, I hear you. I hear you. Okay. I'm sorry, Steve. I gotta skip the other two because we're running low on time. Maybe I can come back to them. But there were two off-topic questions that I wanted to get to. Jendo asks, what is your favorite drink/cocktail? Which I'm obsessed with this answer because I really do want to know. I think I know Andrew, so I'm going to come to you last. Jerry, what's your favorite alcoholic drink? Or it doesn't have to be alcoholic, but favorite drink or cocktail?
I like good bourbon on the rocks.
Nice. Has to be on the rocks. You need ice in it?
Yes, I need a little. Maybe it's because I'm getting older. It bites a little. I need some ice in there.
Okay. All right. I don't think you drink. Do you drink? You don't have to answer.
I don't drink in front of people as a general rule, but I also just generally don't drink that much on my own. So
more people should take really. That stance.
I have enough other things that get me the high that I need that I don't really need booze. When I want a really nice drink for myself, like I want to feel good about myself, what I do is I'll take a can of Coke, I'll stick it in the freezer for an hour, and then I'll pour it into a frosted mug. So that gives me kind of like an icy without having to go to a 7-Eleven.
I love that. I think that's the perfect
way to enjoy a Coke.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. Andrew, what is your favorite drink?
If you can find a place that will make a very properly made old fashioned, I like an old fashioned with a rye. It's very good. It can't be super sweet. Keep all the extra sugar and crap out of it. Just like an old fashioned is a very simple drink, and it should just be very simple with one ice cube. And like that's perfect. I could have one of those any given time. Maybe, you know, even right now, 1:45 on a Thursday, this would be a perfect time for it.
Why not?
Exactly.
Let's get in on it. Okay, mine is a Manhattan. I love the same as Andrew. I just love a good Manhattan. Most places that know how to make cocktails can obviously make a good Manhattan. A lot of places don't. They either go too hard on the vermouth, or they give you bitters that have been sitting out for years and don't taste good, or they're just, you know, they put too much in, or the ratio's off, or whatever. But if you have a good bourbon or a good bourbon, you know, decent vermouth and the right bitters, and you know, just a tiny little bit of cherry, it's perfect. It's amazing.
Good bourbon at a bar is a difficult call. I drink 7 and 7 at a bar because that's hard to mess up.
Actually, I want to know, like, this is the homework for people listening. What's your favorite drink or cocktail? Because we have a very wide swath of the population around the world, and I would love to hear what your favorite drinks are. So let us know. And then Harmless Carl asks, and this is going to be for Ara. We'll end the show on this. My daughter and me are excited for Disney Plus, but we have a free Apple TV Plus for a year. Should we still buy it? And I can guess what the answer is going to be.
Yeah. I mean, Apple TV Plus just isn't going to have a whole lot of original content, especially, and they're not even going to have a whole lot of kids content, even with, I think they have like the entire Peanuts collection or something, but there's still not going to be that much kids content on Apple TV Plus, at least not in the first 12 to 18 months.
And the thing is that you already have it. So it's not like you're looking at paying for both. It's like you're going to have the Apple TV Plus anyway, and it's pretty easy to see the value in Disney Plus.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're a Verizon Unlimited customer, you're getting a year of Disney Plus too. But if you haven't bought a bundle yet and you're any sort of a sports fan, the best thing to do now is wait until November 12th and then get the bundle that's Hulu, the ad-supported Hulu, ESPN Plus, and Disney Plus for $12.99 a month.
That is a great deal. Holy moly.
Yeah.
That's going to be a lot of people.
Yeah, that's going to save you like $5 to $7 a month as opposed to paying for them all separately.
Can't wait for like 9 months from now when it's actually 4 times that price.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, I don't think they're going to do any huge price raises in the first 18 months, especially when so many of us just went whole hog and did that D23 subscription. There's a number of us that have service for who are signed up for 3 years of service. So, and we already gave them our money.
I'm just mad that I have to wait until November 19th to sign up here in Canada. I don't understand why they're doing that, but
wait, they're not doing pre-order in Canada? Why not?
Why would I pre-order a TV subscription.
You don't get charged until after the 7-day free trial ends.
Yeah, but I mean, I just don't have access to the service until the 19th. That just annoys me. But that's because I want to watch, you know, The Mandalorian and all that. Although I'm probably going to have to pirate it because everybody's going to watch The Mandalorian on November 12th anyway. So
it's not on my list for day one, actually. We have other people covering that I'm going to spend day one on the things that I want to watch.
Well, there is plenty to watch, including the 3-hour YouTube greatest hits list, if you just want to get a preview of that. All right.
You're going to need an old fashioned or three to get through that, Manhattan. 3-hour and 20-minute video. I mean, my God.
I'll need a 3 Manhattans, 3 seven and sevens, 3 old fashions, and three nice cold Cokes. All right. we're going to end it there. We got it at an hour and a half, which I'm impressed by. Thank you so much, everybody, for sending in your questions. This is not the only Q&A show that we will have. We will do these on a regular basis.
Yeah, I like these a lot.
With new guests. We tried to get Michael Fisher on to answer a few of these, but Mr. Mobile is moving. If you've been following him on the gram, he's been shifting. He's uprooting his life from Boston to New York City. He's going to move to Brooklyn, where he's going to be putting together a whole bunch of really, really great new content with some cool new creators. So follow him there. And everybody, if you're interested, you can follow us all on the Twitters and send us questions. Andrew, you're at Andrew Martinick. Ara, you're at Ara Wagco. And Jerry, you're at GB Hill. And I'm at Journey Dan. Guys, thank you so much. This was a great show. Send in your thoughts, your suggestions, your comments, your favorite drinks to podcast and Android Central. We love hearing from you. All right, that's it. We're out. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Peace.